Blog Talk Radio.
It's Friday. Do you know what time it is?
That's right, ladies and gentlemen, it is that time, and yes, I know, I keep getting asked that question, did Dan Aykroyd actually do that for us? Yes, he did. He was actually up here at South by Southwest in San Antonio, Texas, well, and it was in Austin, where South by Southwest, but we got the chance to go get it from him, and he was really awesome about it. And for those who don't know, he actually works with MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network, so he is big on paranormal, and if you don't know, also, he does have his own brand of spirits out, so to say, so you can go look that up. But tonight we are continuing the discussion. Now, last week we had the skeptic in here, and we did do some questions with that, but tonight I'm breaking out all the stops. You know, we're going straight to get the answers, and I am bringing in a very special gentleman from across the globe, believe it or not. Who has been really kind to join us. And not only, you know, because I know a lot of people said, oh, it's just going to be recorded. He did one step better, folks. He is here with me live right now, and that is Mr. Colin McLaren.
How are you, AW?
Doing wonderful. And you?
You're pretty good, thank you.
Now, I want to get a little bit of background for everyone on who you are. Now, I went from the documentary that, you know, and explained, and I know I've been online, I've done all that research, but it sounds better when it comes from the person themselves. And, of course, in the documentary, it talks about how you took down five of the, you know, mafia bosses, but you've been in the industry, in the detective industry, for quite some time.
Yes, I first started off as a rookie policeman and graduated to be a detective. This was all way back in the 1980s. And throughout the hard times of the 80s, I think globally, was probably the toughest, and 1990s, the toughest period to be a detective or law enforcement officer anywhere in the world. And then Australia is a very big country, and we have just the same sort of problems as you do in throughout America. So I've had a long association with law enforcement, and principally as a team leader or detective sergeant.
Right, which is really cool. And then, of course, you know, so you know, obviously, the law inside and out, and so it makes it easier. But I think probably what helps a lot with what you do or what you've done for what we're going to talk about tonight is that you really know how to dig in and look for answers where a lot of people might not even think to go.
Yeah, most of my career has been in homicides, murder investigations or child rapes, some really serious national crimes here in Australia, and the mafia investigations, of course, I'm probably most known for 3 years of supposedly bringing down the mafia in one major three-year investigation. But as a detective, I guess I'm a practitioner, and I used to lecture as a detective as well at the detective training school, the new rookies and the new guys coming through. So it's my bent, I guess. It's what I've done is focus on crime scenes, cold case studies, and investigations.
Right, which brings us to what we're discussing tonight, and it's a 50-year mystery that's, now, and I've got to say, and I know you probably have heard many different things. I'm sure you've heard all kinds of feedback from you know, your investigation and so forth. But there's still people who, I guess if they hear the truth, they don't want to believe.
I guess there's another way of saying it, too. And someone recently said this to me, and I'll use their words because it's spot on. Sometimes the truth isn't sexy enough. And that's a fact, you know. Detectives are confronted with this time and time again. And when you're, I guess, giving evidence in court, Supreme Court or a county court, in front of a trial and a jury, you know, sometimes the basic truth is just not sexy enough. But of course, you can't jazz it up. You can't exaggerate it. You have to just be factual. And sometimes just people want sort of a Hollywood-style conspiracy theory to play the role or to be the answer. And when you say it's simply not, it's a straightforward case of this and this and this, and the outcome is simple, they get a little bit sort of disappointed.
Yeah, you know, one of the things, and of course we're doing this on a show, because I could have done this. I have a show that I do where I do different interviews of different individuals, but we're doing this one on a show called Paranormal. And one of the things that people look at it is that it's like one of the most controversial things out there. You know, there's so much, you know, I don't know how to put it in the right words at the moment because I got so many running through my head. But, I mean, we've got the government conspiracies. We've got, you know, not mafia conspiracies. What was the other one?
Fidel Castro in Cuba.
Yeah, that one. I mean, it's just like there were so many different areas that people just want to say this is how it happened, you know. Mm. And I think for me, the way I've always looked at paranormal is if they ever did bring out the truth, you know, of whatever event, like, oh, my God, ghosts do actually exist. People are going to say, well, I see it, but I don't believe it.
That's right. Yeah, and there's been so many, with JFK's death, so many weird and wacky theories leveled at it, and some very sensible ones. You know, it might have been, for example, it could have been an attempt by the Russian government to pay back the U.S. administration and JFK personally, because if you look at the backdrop of that era, that 1963, JFK had been victorious, been very strong against the Russians with the Bay of Pigs issue, the invasion down there in Cuba, and just after that, more importantly, the missiles of October, when Khrushchev had all the missiles lined up in Cuba ready to fire them off into USA. And because of JFK and his brother and the strong administration, they were victorious, and the world just, I thought, was in awe of this administration. And then, of course, sometime just after, JFK is assassinated, murdered, and, of course, it becomes logical that it could have been Russia, but it simply wasn't.
Right. Well, I mean, it just would make sense that it wasn't exactly... I think, for me, the obvious wasn't, at the time, wasn't obvious, as we would say. You know, like, if they were, the Mafia or Russia or, you know, that would just be too simple. That would have been too simple. But the fact is that it is something else. And I got to say, after watching the documentary, my jaw hit the ground. I was blown away. I was like, oh, my God, that makes so sense. How could we have missed that? So, you know, and we'll get into that. But there is one burning question that I would love to ask, and we get this chance to now. What got you interested in trying to solve the answer?
I had a long career, as I said earlier, with a lot of homicides and a lot of really bad murder investigations. And I guess when you're playing on that field, on that level, as a detective, you obviously take an interest in other sort of serious crimes on that level. And JFK is certainly a very serious murder. You know, it's an assassination and all this. But if you just break it down to what it is, it's a very serious murder or killing of a very important person. And any detective who's done those sorts of cases naturally lends his thoughts and ideas and to it and thinks about it perhaps more than most people. And along the way, as all these sort of solutions and conspiracy theories unfolded over the years and decades, I used to sort of put them into my thinking and try to work out, is this feasible? Is this possible? And work through it. And, of course, each time I came up with a zero, and that's just the detective in me, but along the way I was just really wanted to one day have a go at it, one day to sit down. If I ever found 4 or 5 years where I was doing nothing, and I had to wait till I resigned, of course, and retired from being a detective, and I had the time, I had the the opportunity. I had the skills to sit down for 4.5 years. And I sort of thought, okay, I can get all the documents, all the statements, all the testimonies, all the evidence, all the exhibits, and I can get them in my lounge room, and I can go through them on my computer, my database, and there's thousands and thousands of pages, and I spent 4.5 years reading everything, and I was determined to have a go and to find an outcome.
Now, see, this leads me to a question, well, two questions at the point, and I didn't think of them until now, because it didn't make, you know, again, like I said, there's just so many questions that lie within this that everybody, you know, they got to know. We know that the Warren Commission or Warren Investigation, you know, that was huge. The paperwork in that is just probably would take years to go through on its own. So what are the files that are supposedly sealed that they don't want to open?
Well, until the Clinton administration, so if you look at the 60s and 70s, all the way through the mid-90s, all of the evidence, all of the documents and testimonies and sworn statements and affidavits were all sealed under the secrecy provisions to do with JFK, and that's okay. You know, that happens, and it certainly doesn't happen as much now, but it used to happen in that old-fashioned time of the 1960s. They would seal things, and they were supposed to be sealed for 75 years. So in other words, anybody who was around back then was certainly going to be dead by the time the seal was cut.
Right.
But Bill Clinton was a little bit more modern, and he was reacting to, I guess, the American people's annoyance about this old-fashioned rule, because they all wanted answers, they wanted information, that they wanted the freedom of information. Rightfully, Clinton decided to pass legislation through your Congress, and they unsealed all of those documents. But it took 4 or 5 years for all those documents to be assessed, accredited, checked, verified, and then released to the public. So now you're talking, you know, in the year 2000, 2002, and 2004. And then it's got to find PDF. It's got to be condensed into PDF so we can all get access to this now wonderful information. Mm-hmm. And that's got to be then libraried and all sorts of issues there for a few more years. And then along comes me, and I sit down and turn my computer on, and all the information is now there. There's no more information that is held secret. It's all out there. It's all freedom of information.
Wow. Okay. And it always makes me wonder, because, you know, you hear again that they're like, oh, they're sealed again. They're not. I think it's, what, another 50 years?
I think of the total amount, EW, I think 3 or 4% of information is still sealed. I just said that it's all out there, but 96 or 97% is all out there. And let me tell you, I've read every document. It took me 4.5 years. I don't know how many millions of words, but certainly there is over 10,000 pages I've read. I can verify to your listeners it's all out there. There's no skullduggery. What they've kept back, that little few percent, is to do with the broader look at his autopsy and, you know, the shocking photos of JFK's body that was blown apart and all of those sorts of gory details. They've held that back for another 6 years. And I think that's probably okay. It didn't worry me as a detective, because I'd found out the reasons for the killing anyway, and it wasn't reliant on that sort of evidence. It was reliant on the evidence of the crime scene itself, the Dealey Plaza at the school book depository.
Right. And then, we'll get to that. I'm so eager to get to the end already, but we can't go there yet. There's so much that we got to go through. Now, there's evidence that, as a detective, and of course, I can't say I'm a detective, but I do like to write, you know, murder mysteries and stuff, and so I know the evidence is what is always followed, and it can't lie. The evidence can't lie.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Okay, so we've got some bits and pieces of evidence that right now are never even, you know, looked at. And the Warren Commission didn't investigate it. You know, there's eyewitnesses that testify to it. But the one that stood out the most right now is the possibility, you know, that there was gun smoke smelled right down on the ground level.
That's probably the most telling piece of evidence that was completely ignored, pushed aside, even though the Warren Commission knew about it, they didn't want to know about it. When you fire a weapon, and let's just say we're talking about a high-powered rifle, well, in fact, any weapon, but certainly a high-powered rifle, what will happen is there will be a mist, or gunshot residue, detectives call it, and forensic people call it, and that's the... Just imagine there's a mist. If the listeners can imagine spraying a can of hairspray or spraying a can of room freshener, that's exactly what we're dealing about. There's a little 1 or 2 meters or a bubble or a, I guess a circle around that rifle of about 1 or 2 yards.
Right.
That's called gunshot residue. That will settle. It'll settle on clothes. It'll settle on cars. It'll settle on anything at all. If you're in a room, it'll settle on the lounge suite. So, of course, you test the lounge suite for the gunshot residue, and that's very scientific. Or you test the shooter's clothes and hands, and that indicates to a jury and proves to a jury that he either held the gun or fired the gun. And it's all these sorts of issues. Now, back in 1963, no one bothered with gunshot residue. They all knew about it. It was used in trials. It was used as with the FBI, etc.
Mm-hmm.
But no one bothered about it in Dallas, Texas. They just let it go and totally forgot about it. So you're reliant on the witnesses. And I found altogether 14 different witnesses that were at street level who saw gun smoke, and another 7 or 8 of them that were at street level that smelled gun smoke. So around about 20 different witnesses were around JFK's car, around the Secret Service follow-up car just behind, that saw and smelled gunshot residue or smoke, as they called it, some of them. Some of them called it gunshot residue. Those people were completely ignored in the Warren Commission, and they shouldn't have been, because Lee Harvey Oswald, you've got to remember, Lee Harvey Oswald, who was blamed as the lone shooter,
right?
He was six stories up in a building, some 85, 90 yards behind the JFK's car, six stories up, and Lee Harvey Oswald was certainly in that book depository, certainly had a gun, and certainly was firing his own gun, but the wind was blowing in his face, so therefore his gunshot residue or his smoke could not possibly, it's an impossibility, could have got down six levels and hung around the Secret Service car, which was immediately behind JFK's limousine. A complete impossibility. So as a detective, it's had alarm bells after alarm bells ringing. What's going on? Something's happened. Some gun has been discharged on the ground at street level, as well as Lee Harvey Oswald's way up on the sixth floor.
Well, there was another bit of that is that even, I think you even mentioned it in a documentary as well, wasn't the motorcade already at 11 miles an hour moving away? So obviously that's still a great enough speed that should the gunshot smoke or smell be anywhere close, they're moving away from it, so that wind would be blowing in towards them, so there would be no way that could still work that way either.
That's correct. A complete impossibility, and it's not even open to conjecture. It's something that just couldn't happen, and I don't think as a forensic scientist or detective anywhere in the world that would differ from that. So you've got a real interesting thing happening as you read through the 10,000 pages of now this information that is freely available that keeps reoccurring time and time again. So then you start thinking, why wasn't that evidence given to the Warren Commission? And then you delve deeper, and then you find out that people signed the affidavits. They certainly signed their testimony, gave it to the Dallas police, and gave it to the Dallas sheriff's office, and even to some FBI people who were running around the crime scene. but they were never invited to give that evidence or encouraged to give it at the important inquiry, which was known as the Warren Commission.
Right, and again, I know, like, per the evidence that was given, 10 people witnessed the smell of powder, plus a police officer.
But just to look at who was smelling this, because they could all have been stupid, they could have all been fools, they could have been all naive, so inexperienced. But what we have, when we look at the professional background of the individuals that were smelling this gun smoke and seeing this gun smoke, one of them was a U.S. Senator Ralph Yarborough.
Mm-hmm.
He had 50 years' experience with firearms, and he had a long career as a Marine, U.S. Marines. So that man is an expert with guns. Then we have another expert hunter, a press man. He was taking photos, and he had been hunting all of his life.
Right.
Then his partner, another fellow alongside him, was, again, an expert hunter. Then a policeman. Then two other policemen on motorbikes saw gun smoke. And then you've got country people and country folks that are used to handling rifles. So all of a sudden you've got a group of witnesses that almost, you could say, are expert in guns and gunpowder.
Mm-hmm.
They're not fools. They're not naive. And so they've become a very valuable, critical mass of witnesses.
Right. Well, and our chat room's lighting up right now, so I've got one gentleman who's a big-time fanatic with guns, so he knows his guns really well. And, of course, he made a comment earlier, and we'll get into where the experts, some of these experts who mentioned it, but he did make a comment earlier that Oswald couldn't have shot the or made the shots with a Carcano, I hope I say the gun right.
That's right.
Now, we do know that at least one of the shots was from that rifle.
Yes, and as a detective, I believe quite clearly that two shots were fired by Lee Harvey Oswald's Carcano rifle. It was an old World War II Italian-made piece of junk, really. And they were an army surplus weapon that were dumped on the U.S. market just after the Second World War, and they were bolt action, very heavy timber stock, and a cumbersome sort of a weapon, but nonetheless he got two shots away with that firearm, and I believe the first missed outright and was a ricochet, hit the ground because his sights were out, and it was proved fairly significantly that his sights were faulty.
Mm-hmm.
And the second shot that Lee got away hit JFK in the back of the neck, the neck muscle there where it just sort of meets with the vertebrae area, and went cleanly through the neck. There's no dispute on this, and it comes out of his voice box, and it's neat as a pin, which is consistent with the type of ammo that Lee was using, which was full metal jacket rounds, which are designed to go neatly and cleanly through the body of a soldier, or in this case, JFK, and then it passed through Governor Connolly as well. So he got two shots away.
Right. Now, I'm not going to have you explain this, and there's a reason why. Folks, you need to get the DVD or go and I know right now currently it's on Netflix, so if you're a subscriber to Netflix, you can go see it there. It's called JFK, The Smoking Gun. In here, in this video, in this documentary, the explanation of the shot that goes through Kennedy into Connolly, which is considered for years the mysterious bullet. Yeah, I still have to laugh at that. But you actually clear that whole thing up in just that portion. And this is not, I mean, radio is a great place to do the talking, but this is a visual effect that people have to see to understand. When I saw this, I'm telling you, it was like, oh my God, lights turned on. I could see, it made perfect sense. And so I encourage everybody to get it. Now, you also have a book out, but it's an e-book form, right?
E-book, yes, JFK, The Smoking Gun is an e-book, and it's also, of course, as a documentary, the DVD documentary on the shelves in your audiovisual stores.
Right. So everybody's got to go get that because, it really is worth it. I mean, that's what really got me to finalize. I think I've been talking about doing a show on this for years. I know for at least the last 5 years I've been saying we're going to do a JFK special. But tonight we're doing it, and your documentary actually got me stoked. I mean, I saw things in there that made perfect sense. I mean,
it follows the rules of evidence, AW. It's not about theories and making wild statements that are without fact. It follows quite seriously the rules of evidence.
Mm-hmm.
So it has a very, very defined parameters that we worked within to study all the evidence. And we're happy it'll withstand any criticism. And it's been out in the open now 6 or 7 months since November last year. And we've had law enforcement officers from around the world. We've had detectives, investigators, even a few judges. I've had all sorts of comments, hundreds of emails, all congratulating myself and the research team for finally getting it right. So it's rules of evidence are important, and that's their basis.
All right. Right. So here's what I am going to do. Now, you explained that the bullet used. Well, let's back up a second. There is a piece of evidence we have to clear up here. In this, a lot of people mentioned that there was 3 casings found where Oswald was. Could you explain why it's not that he took 3 shots?
Sure. When you look at the evidence and everything beforehand, you have Lee Harvey Oswald practicing constantly. He was going out into the field. In fact, it was Love Field Airport. He was going out in the backfields of that area, and he was doing target shooting and practicing. And he was hiding his gun. He was burying the gun in the soil. So if you look at it from a Marine's point of view, because he's an ex-Marine, a poor shot, there's nothing remarkable about him, but nonetheless he was an ex-Marine, and he had some firearm skills, out every night in the cold and burying his gun, hiding it in the dirt. So that is quite normal, and certainly not abnormal for a hunter or even a Marine in those sorts of combat or guerrilla conditions, I guess, that you would use a plug that is a spent round, a spent casing, an empty casing that is being fired. You keep it in the chamber,
mm-hmm.
and then you put the bolt down, and then, of course, you'd wrap the gun up because you could, could get wet and rusted. So what the spent casing does is stops grit, stops dirt, and any sort of moisture getting into the very important chamber of the weapon. And that's where we see the 3 spent casings at the crime scene, at the book depository. The first one, which is a distance away from another 2, and the other 2 were grouped close together, the first one is dented, and I say is the plug, because if it was dented, it wouldn't have been able to eject in a normal firing, close working of the rifle. If you're just firing it one round after the other, it would have jammed. So that seems to be the plug that he's used when he's freed the gun up. He's then loaded it and aimed and fired 2 rounds, and that's where the 2 have grouped together at the floor just near the window.
Now, we do got to mention there's 2 other people who've talked about this as well. Now, there was a ballistics expert who started this, I guess dedicated his career and everything to get an answer on this, and that was Howard Donahue.
That concludes this episode of Paranormal. Join in on the exciting conclusion as they uncover the compelling evidence of who actually shot President Kennedy. If you want to continue listening to more on-air episodes of Paranormal, you can do so every Friday on TMV Cafe Radio at www.tmvcafe.com. Or get the free TuneIn.com app and listen to TMV Cafe Radio 24 hours a day. They are San Antonio's only independent music artist station. See you next time with the answer to who shot JFK.